Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll have music from and conversation with Jimmy Clanton. Dominating the charts in the late 50s into the early 60s, he gave us Venus in Blue Jeans, Go Jimmy Go, Just a Dream, and more. He was known as the Swamp Pop R&B teen idol. Clanton will be in the area mid-November. We'll have details later in the program. With the recent passing of actress and singer Diane Carroll, we're going to begin tonight's KVC Arts stepping into the KVC Archives. Here we have KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Carroll when she stopped into the KVCR studios in 2010 when she was promoting the PBS special, Diane Carroll, The Lady, The Music, The Legend. She spoke about her book as well.
You talk about being from the Bronx. Can you share a little bit about your childhood and growing up in the Bronx?
Actually, my mother sort of played a trick on my father. I was supposed to have been born elsewhere, a different hospital. I think they had a little tiff, and all of a sudden it was time for her to deliver. Voila. And she took a taxi to the Bronx. We actually lived in Manhattan, and I was born there. And the only thing I remember about it is that it was not far from the zoo. But it was a wonderful place to go, the Bronx Zoo. And later in life, I said to my mother, we're in the zoo now. Where is the hospital? She said, they've torn it down. And I hope that I had nothing to do with that. But growing up in Manhattan is incredible. I know people like to believe that it's not a place to bring up a child. It's not true. There are so many choices of things to expose them to. We have the best museums. We have the kind of schooling, if given half a chance to be a proper school, that makes all of the teachers, the principals, whatever, curious to bring New York City into our lives, particularly those of us that they feel the parents do not have the time or the money to do so. So they get special dispensation to take us wherever it is they feel that meaning all of us, would be interested. New York is also a place that makes you grow up. During one of my marriages, I had some lovely young ladies who were, of course, my stepdaughters, and I adored them. And I really didn't have any idea how overwhelmed they were by big cities. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really late in life to be that intimidated by a city. Because I was born and raised in New York City, so naturally I felt that way. And their fear and their lack of comprehension was real. And I thought that was sad, because it's a part of life that is important, and it offers information, it offers spice, it offers direction to everyone. I'm not saying you have to live there, but at least you must visit.
It's a fabulous place, too. There's so much culture, so much going on, and it never sleeps.
No.
It's a fabulous city, and I love it. I only like it in short doses. Mm-hmm. Tell me, you were close with both your parents, extremely close with your mother, and she kind of moved you into this world? Was it because she just liked to doll you up?
I think that her involvement was because I was extremely serious about it. I don't think my mother ever thought my daughter's going to be in show business. I could never say my mother was a show business mom.
No.
She said, you know, why do you want to do that? And I said, well, let's make crepe paper costumes for the play in school, and you show me. I really brought her into this. And she began to enjoy it. And then eventually she became convinced that I was going to do it with or without her, that I really had to do it. I didn't really have a choice. So there was a lot about it that she enjoyed and a lot I think she could have done without. But she supported me all the way.
Were you able to sing just God-given talent? Or did you come in through the modeling because of your God-given beauty? What's worked for you?
I started singing when I was about six. Songs from Disney and wonderful little plays that we did in school. You know, I thought I was a snowman standing next to each other, and I loved it. And I rehearsed, and my mother had to sit and watch and listen. How was that, Mom? And so it was a gift. It was certainly a gift. I was not afraid at all. I was only afraid if I had not prepared properly. If I was prepared, I just knew that it was mine. I was going to have a good time. I don't really think I ever aspire to do anything else.
It is in your book that Diane Carroll was not your born...
My name is Carol Diane Johnson.
Johnson.
That's correct.
And you were with your young friend doing something, and she renamed you?
Alice Oppenheim. We were students in the High School of Music and Art, and she wanted to go on Arthur Godfrey, I think. And so we went and we auditioned. We were adorable in our little petticoats and so on and so forth. So the person in charge of talent said to us, that was very nice, but you do realize that your card reads Oppenheim and Johnson. So we expected older people who were part of vaudeville. Can you do something about that name? So that evening, she called me very late, and she said, how would you like to be Diane Carroll? I was doing my homework, and I said, it doesn't matter. I don't care. And she changed her name to Lisa Collins. So we were very proud of ourselves, and we sang tenderly. She played the piano.
The name stuck with you. You kept the name.
Yes. I really, thought, what's in a name?
And did your father mind?
A little. Absolutely. A little. I said, Dad, I only know Van Johnson. I don't know any ladies in show business who would be called Miss Johnson. So it was okay. The most important thing is that my parents felt that I should not force myself to do this. If this was something that I really believed that I could do, then they were there.
You believed you can do it, and did you believe you did it well?
I'm highly critical of everything I do to this day. I will see this film with us and say, oh, why did I say that? Why did I do that? Why did I? I think it comes with the territory. I think if you're going to be in front of an audience, they deserve to see the best that you can do in that area.
But don't they also deserve to see who you are, too? I mean, you are human. You are, you're, always on a stage, but they also want to see you.
Well, I think you bring that to the stage. You bring your humanity if you're about that.
Right.
And you bring in your choice of songs and your repartee with them. Many things that sometimes are very personal. Mm. The nightclub scene, when I grew up, you have to be Perks. Everybody's been referring to me tonight. She's old. This is old music and old. That was a wonderful time.
It was a great time.
It was an incredible time.
It had to be.
We don't have that. And we'll never have it again.
Right. I agree with you.
And I am so proud that I was alive at that time. I'm enjoying this period and watching you guys trying to find out what technology is going to take you where in the next 2 minutes, because I'm not going with you. But it was really one of the most magnificent expressions of who we are as human beings, and finding out that we could say and do a lot of things that were absolutely forbidden to our parents. I mean, my mother was not allowed to go to the movies, much less to theater. I'm very happy to have been there and that I'm still here.
It seems like your mother was very interested in how you dressed, how you presented yourself, and fashion was very important. And you've carried that, I think, through all your years to today. You continue to care about how you look and that fashion is important. Did she instill that in you?
Yeah, she really was. People judge you by what you wear. And it was very important then, in particular, to striving Black Americans who are in the process of moving from the South, where everything was so uncomfortable and so unkind, to the North. So dressing to suit the part is what she would say.
That's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Diane Carroll in an interview from 2010. Carroll passed away October 4th, 2019 at the age of 84. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming live at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
Your parents left you, and you wrote in your book, at an early age.
Doesn't that sound terrible?
They left to go do better for
true.
You.
No, it's
they,
true.
They left
yes.
because they wanted more for their daughter.
Yes.
And they wanted to make a better living or whatever. And then you stayed with your grandmother, and as soon as things were better, you came to live with them, of course. But you talk about in your book how you carried that with you for a long time. But did you understand it more when you were working and you had to leave your daughter? You didn't.
No.
No, it hurt you throughout. It stayed
yes,
with you.
It still does. The word left has affected my entire life.
Mm.
Of course I understand. I mean, I'm an adult. She wanted more and he wanted more. And they had no education. And the only thing to do was work wherever they could.
Right.
And that meant leaving me with different people. And my mother didn't like that at all. So actually, she took me to her sister.
Mm.
And I lived there. And it was the first time I had ever seen an outhouse. You don't even know what that is, do you?
Oh, yes, I do.
Do you really?
Yes, yes.
And I thought, where am I? I was a little thing.
Right.
But when my mother came to pick me up, see, the next morning I learned my mother had left. Mm. She put me to bed, and I thought she was going to bed. So I awaken the next morning and no mother. I've told that story 50,000 times. It still bothers me. It doesn't bother everybody else, but it still bothers me. But I loved her very much, and I knew that they did what they thought was best. But there were many, many things that never developed with the way they might have had that not have happened, because that hurt was always in the way, always.
And it proved to be in your way for more of your life.
To this day, we're sitting right here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about television
and
Julia. As a young girl, I was watching you on television and loved the show. I loved the man that played Nolan. I can't think of his first name. Lloyd Nolan.
Right.
That played the doctor. It was just
a
wonderful show.
Actor.
He was. Yeah. He was great. It was a great combination. The show did very well. I mean, I didn't know this when I was in third or fourth grade when I was watching it, but I remember loving the show. I've since read of how you were the first black woman to lead this, and a lot of things responsibilities might have fallen on you. I was a little girl watching the show thinking it was just great. Corey was just cute, and it was just a fun show.
Well, that's what you were supposed to think at your age.
What was it for
you? Did your mother insist that you watch?
No. No, my dad thought you were so beautiful. That's why we watched.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
So,
thank you.
And I just happened to love the show, but it was my father saying that, you know, that's why we watched.
I'm sure that somewhere, and what nationality are you?
Hispanic.
I'm sure that somewhere in the back of his head, your father was happy to see a woman not of a white hue on camera, on screen. Although that's the mail I got almost every day, barrels of it, that they had not seen this as something to expose their children. So, yeah, Hal Cantor is the name of the creator. Mm. A very interesting creator, because Hal Cantor also helped to create something called Amos and Andy.
You've had a few marriages.
Four.
Okay. And you've had some...
Is that a few or a lot?
Well, few is three.
Oh, this is a lot.
You were kind enough to admit four. I think you read in your book, Who Am I Competing With? Elizabeth Taylor. But you've since stopped. But you also had some long relationships with some very big names in Hollywood, one being Sidney Poitier and the other David Frost. Why didn't you marry David Frost?
It was Tuesday, and I was
not
busy.
A good day for that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's something that should be said here about our culture. I think during my upbringing, there was about as much information about how to select a partner as how to make pancakes out of sand. And trying to have a career and believing in all those silly romantic movies, as I said to you, I am a romanticist. I thought you meet this wonderful, delicious human being, and you say, I love you, and you get married. I'm not saying that I wasn't ignorant. I was. But I have since had the great fortune of being alone. And I have learned that that's what I did not learn first. Mm-hmm. That was, who is this person over here trying to join this person over here, and why? So, I adore you, I love you meant dum-bum-ba-dum. And I think it's very nice now that I have this time to try to find out who I am. Maybe a little late, but so far it's okay.
It's okay. What did you like about men? Was it their humor, their good looks would engage you, or just the fact that they would tell you you're beautiful and let's get married?
Well, each man has a different thing. I can't say that he was funny and he wasn't. The sense of humor, if it melds with mine, and we understand it, it's very, very attractive.
So not one thing is what you were looking for?
No, because I was really looking for a billionaire, and I never found him.
Darn it. Hate when that happens.
Isn't it awful?
Yes, it is, doggone it. You were diagnosed with breast cancer.
Yes.
You're a survivor of breast cancer, an advocate, and have gone on to talk about it. When you got the word that you had cancer, what ran through your head?
I didn't believe what I was hearing, and I told the doctor that I really had to hang up and that I would call him back in a few minutes, because it all of a sudden became surreal. I thought, I'm not standing here talking to
my dad. I didn't just hear that man say that.
He didn't say that. Right. What's going on? So I waited a few minutes and I called him back, and he said, yes, it's true. Fortunately for you, it's quite early. It was less than a centimeter. So I have wonderful doctors. I really want everyone to hear me when I say that. I was very fortunate to be a part of Screen Actors Guild and AGVA and all of them, because they are doctors who interact with each other about everything. The person that has nothing to do with cancer will still talk to the oncologist to explain what he may have found in some other areas.
Right.
And as a team, they talked me through it. And I've been fortunate enough to talk to women and men who have gone through the breast cancer scare. And some of the information that I was able to impart, I received more so in return. Mm. Also, some of the situations, which I had no idea, 20-some-odd-year-old woman going to have a double mastectomy a week from the day she and I met. And the reason that she came to see me that day was to ask if I would stay with her until it was over. Some incredible experiences with human beings that I don't think I would have had under different circumstances.
I love the cover of the book. When you read the book, it says that your photo shoot that day was supposed to go one way. You didn't have, I guess the wardrobe didn't work out, and you improvise with this. Is that part true?
Yes, it's the photographer's shirt.
But it looks fabulous on you.
Isn't it great?
You wore it so well.
And someone lent me a belt, I think. Maybe the skirt is mine, I'm not sure. But I knew that we had to do it that day. Everyone had flown in from New York, and the photographer was very difficult to book and that sort of thing. And so we went ahead with the photos that day.
I think it looks great. Were you happy with it?
I was.
Yeah.
I am. I think the little photograph is adorable.
I think it is. And those legs, I love the name of the book. The legs are the last to go, and
yes,
they're still holding strong right
there.
They're
doing there. Pretty good.
They are doing
the
very
knees
well.
Are giving me a hard time.
One of the things you also say, and I so believe this, you like to wear heels. They're the symbol of sensuality.
Men love high heel shoes.
I agree with
you.
They
love it. I mean, no matter what, the length of the leg in that high heel shoe, and that we're risking our lives to make them feel happy, makes them very happy. I do it as often as I can.
Because the higher you are, it's a bigger fall when
That's
you go
right.
down, isn't it?
And these new shoes, they are definitely
goodness.
Out to get us this time.
I want to talk just for a second about your daughter. You had one daughter, Suzanne.
Mm-hmm.
She now has a couple of children, so
two
you now
children,
have
two
grandchildren.
Yes.
And how is that relationship?
It's up and down. Mm-hmm. We're two women and strong. And as a friend of mine told me years ago, two women cannot live in the same house. But she has been generous with her time and her caring and with my grandchildren. We're working it out. Working it out.
Good. You end the book by saying that, and I quote, "Some people come of age as teenagers. I came of age as a senior citizen."
I did.
You learned through all of this time who you are and what you're comfortable in?
I learned that I needed to let go. Who I am is of no, whatever it is. If I see an area that needs to be improved, improve it. It's not a cause. It's just a life. As I said earlier, I'm certainly not as rigid as I used to be. I thought that everything that I thought was correct, and that everyone else was wrong. So that's not true. Whatever it takes to get you down the road, the next mile.
Is what it takes.
Yes. Don't hurt others. Don't hurt other people. That's the most important thing, I think.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you very much.
Yes, everything's as if we never said.
That was KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Diane Carroll in an interview from 2010 when Carroll was in the KVCR studios around the time of her PBS special, Diane Carroll, The Lady, The Music, The Legend. Carroll passed away October 4th, 2019, at the age of 84. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Coming up November 16th, it's Legends of the 60s, Volume 3. More at affordablemusicproductions.com, but part of the lineup, Jimmy Clanton, with hits all over the top of the charts in the late 50s and early 60s. He was known as the Swamp Pop R&B Teen Idol.
I think the Teen Idol thing came from a combination of Dick Clark and Alan Freed. Between the two of them, I think that's how the Teen Idol came about. The Swamp Pop thing kind of came about little by little over a few years. Reason being is that down in Louisiana, the truth of the matter is Swamp Pop is a combination of rock and roll and rhythm and blues. The reason being is that Swamp Pop always has horns. And all of my early records and the band that I was with, we all had a horn section as well as full rhythm. That was why it was called Swamp Pop. It was rock and roll with rhythm and blues, because rhythm and blues always seem to have horns. And the artists down there in the early day, Ray Charles, Lloyd Price, and of course Fats Domino, Little Richard, these were all artists that I was very influenced by. Even in my first band, we had horns and a full rhythm section. And so that's really where the Swamp Pop came from. Okay. And truthfully, I say this with no reservations now. I never considered myself a part of the New York, Jersey, Philadelphia, doo-wop, Philly sound. I always, my roots stayed with that Swamp Pop sound. And all the fans that I have, I've got over 8,000 on Facebook. They all love that Swamp Pop, horns in the background sound that Jimmy Clanton had. And, you know, it wasn't the Bobby Rydell, Philadelphia, Frankie Avalon sound, I'll admit that. And it wasn't the Mellow Kings, Tonight of New York, you know. So was I different? I guess I was, but that's where the Swamp Pop came about. And truthfully, I found out, once I went in with the national exposure, I found out that the girls considered me a cute, good-looking kid. And so that's how the Teen Idol thing came about.
Excellent. And that deep down in your heart, you mean every word you said, that no one could change my place.
Just a dream, just a dream, just
a dream. All our plans. This may be a chicken or the egg kind of thing. Was Just a Dream, was that the song that landed you on Dick Clark's American Bandstand, or was it you performing that song on American Bandstand that caused it to blow up?
Well, I want to be humble about this.
Okay, good for you. Appreciate it.
It was a combination of the song and my Louisiana twang. And then once I made the first national exposure, the girls really, really got close to me, because I was told that I was a real good-looking kid. And on top of that, you could sing. So, you know, that combination really is what accelerated a career overnight, beginning with me singing Just a Dream on Dick Clark's show, 1958, American Bandstand. Within a matter of 10 days, I was just bombarded with invites to do shows, national exposure with a major booking agency. It was literally overnight because of that initial Dick Clark American Bandstand 1958 show that I did.
Wow. At this point, I guess you finally quit your day job.
Well, actually, it's kind of funny, because I didn't have a day job. I was in Baton Rouge. I was going to LSU. I was going to college.
Oh.
And so my whole plan was, I'm going to be a geologist, find out where oil is, and I'll do the geology Monday through Friday. And then I love to play the guitar, and so I'm going to do the gigs on weekends, and I'm going to do that till I fall over. But then one day, I had a good, quick, basic algebra thinking, and one day I sat down and I said, wait a minute, our band is so popular, and I am popular, and I'm making $40 to $45 a night. Now, this is 1957.
Sure.
So, you know, $45 in 1957, what would that be today, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I went, I said, now, well, let's see, if I go just 4 years to college, or, you know, and then, of course, get my master's, 5 years in school, and I'm doing $40 to $45 a night, four to five nights a week. Whatever job I get in geology, could I make up that 5 years that would cost me those engagements? So I thought for about 5 minutes and decided, you know what, the music is really coming off. But I've got to tell you, this to me, this is so interesting. I never wanted to do the singing. I only wanted to be a guitar player.
Really?
And I mean, I taught myself. I became an expert guitar player.
Nice.
And so I was playing with this one little band right around the time I was a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I overheard the band leader, this is out of context,
okay.
I overheard the band leader say to this other guy in the band, he said, well, I have to pay him $5 a night more because he sings. I went, whoa. And I had sung, but it was, you know, really in a Baptist church just from a hymn book.
Oh, sure. Right.
I never thought about singing, so I forgot about that. And then about a year later, I start working with this group called The Rockets.
Right.
Because they really wanted a guitar player, and I was really the best white guitar player in all of Baton Rouge. And so I ended up playing with this guy because he had engagements. And I was 18 by then. I just turned 18. And in Louisiana, you could go into a place that served alcohol at 18. So he had all these gigs. So I thought about it. I said, you know what, that band leader, he gave that one guy $5 a night more for singing. Now, $5 a night more, you know, again, $5 in 1957, you know what that would buy, you know what I mean? I mean, still in those days, a Coke was a nickel, a hot dog was 10 cents, you could go to the movies for 20 cents. So I went to Dick Holler and I said, Dick, I said, you know, you're doing all the singing all night, and man, that must be tiring on you. I said, now look, I said, I'd be willing to do a song here or there. I said, however, the band I used to be with, the guy that sang, got $5 a night additional. And he looked at me and he said, well, let's just try it out. I said, okay. I'll never forget this. On Specialty Label, there was one of the Neville brothers. His name was Aaron.
Oh my gosh.
Dick says, okay, we'll try it. So I'll never forget this. I heard that record, and by the way, there was no cassette tape. You couldn't record things, no such thing invented. So you would have to buy the magazine with the words in it or buy the record and memorize. So I heard this song. I'll never forget it. It was a song called Ooh Wee Baby.
Ooh Wee Baby.
Ooh Wee Baby, I love, love, love you so. Ooh Wee Baby, don't ever let me go. Fool that I am to think you could love me too. And then the horns would go, bum, da, 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 da. That was the sound.
Nice.
And so I learned it. So I told Dick, I said, okay, I'm ready to show. He said, okay. So never knowing what was going to happen, I went up to the mic and we kick off the song. And as we're doing this song, everybody pretty much stopped dancing, and everybody just gravitated right down to the front of the stage, the guys as well as all the girls. And they were all just looking up and staring at me. And I'll never forget as long as I live. This one guy, because, you know, you would think that the guys didn't want the girls staring at Jimmy.
Yeah.
But this one guy looked up the other guy while I was singing, and I read his lips. He said, wow. He said, that guy can sing.
Wow.
Yeah, and so that did it. So very shortly, I started making the $5 a night more, and I started singing. And truthfully, in no time at all, I was really the main attraction for the band. And that's how I ended up. Boy, I could go on and on and on. How Just a Dream came about is really a Happy Days script.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Coming up November 16th, it's Legends of the 60s, Volume 3. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. But part of the lineup is tonight's guest, Jimmy Clanton, topping the charts starting in the late 50s with Just a Dream. He had Go Jimmy Go in 1960 and Venus in Blue Jeans in 62.
So Just a Dream comes out locally, and one day Johnny Vincent calls me. It's April of 1958. And he said, I want you to pack a suitcase. You're going to be on this new show called American Bandstand, this guy Dick Clark, and it's really the rage. He said, I'm going to fly you to Philadelphia. Well, that's like saying to me, I am going to take you in a NASA rocket to Mars. Philadelphia? Good Lord have mercy. I've never been in an airplane, never been out of the Gulf Coast, of course.
Yeah.
So I fly to Philadelphia. Now, there was no FedEx in those days, no photocopy machines, no email. So I am almost positive that when I got there to do this Just a Dream, they did not know anything about what I look like. Now, this is how I found out something. You go, no, 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 ladies and gentlemen, with a new song, and it's really become very popular. Would you welcome Jimmy Clanton? Well, I step out there, and I'm telling you, I thought there was something wrong with how I was dressed because all of the girls just stared holes through me. And that's when it came later. Even a guy took he did an interview with me. He said, have you ever had any idea how good looking you were? I never thought about that. So all the guys that I went to school with, we were all good looking guys in high school. So none of us stood out from the other. Well, that's what happened. And so the next thing you know, Johnny Vincent got orders for over 100,000 copies of that record the very next day.
Oh my gosh.
The next day. Within 2 weeks, I am flying to New York. I'm signing with a major booking agency. And the next thing I know, Alan Freed had already asked for me. I'm doing all of Alan Freed's shows. I become his favorite white male artist.
My gosh.
I was on all his shows. I was the lead in his iconic rock and roll movie, Go Johnny Go, all of the Dick Clark things. And that never, ever stopped until the English invasion.
Mm.
After the English invasion, I was in the army. I came out, and lo and behold, I come out, and what greets me but a song called Venus in Blue Jeans?
Yes, indeed.
And bam, I'm back again. And now, 60 years later, I have a fan following that is phenomenal. All of my songs are as popular now. Even the B-side of all my records are popular with all my fans. And when I do a show here and there, they're there by the thousands, and it's just phenomenal.
Absolutely. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Coming up November 16th at Gardner Spring Auditorium in Ontario, it's Legends of the 60s, Volume 3. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. The lineup includes Paul and Paula, Bobby Rydell, Brian Hyland, Dodie Stevens, The Modern Gentleman, and tonight's guest, Jimmy Clanton.
She's Venus in blue jeans, Mona Lisa with a ponytail. She's a walking, talking work of art.
You mentioned you were one of the few white singers to come out of the New Orleans R&B rock and roll sound. Were you played equally on the black radio stations of the time, or any challenge getting you on the air with that kind of?
That's interesting, because I was told in 1958 that Just a Dream was number one in the R&B market.
Yes, yes, indeed. Well, you know what? This happened with the good-looking thing, so I'm just going to go ahead and ask this. I don't think this question is too far out of line, because we've heard this about other people. Any instances that you can recall about getting to a gig and only then folks finding out that you're white?
You know, that's very interesting. That's a very good question. I've got a heck of a reply for that. Again, remember, there was no such thing invented called the photocopy machine, email. So everything was by regular U.S. mail. Just think about that.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
I've got this gig, and I'm going to Philadelphia, and I'm going to be one of the artists at the Uptown Theater. Now, let's face facts. We're talking about 1958. My high school was all white kids. My neighborhood was white kids. But nothing ever arose in Baton Rouge where there was a race problem. Ever. When I was growing up. Ever.
Nice. Wow.
We didn't see them in our side of town. They didn't see us in their side of town. But everybody, I mean, we just lived a very normal, happy day's life in Baton Rouge. That's just the way it was, as far as I knew. But I get to Philadelphia, and they book me into a hotel, and I don't see another white person there but me. And I'll be honest with you, I got scared to death.
Oh.
Because I didn't realize what was happening to me emotionally, but it was like I'm in a foreign land. I mean, just think, Lord, I just turned 19, you know? I've never been out of Louisiana in my life, never been on an airplane. I mean, I'm a fish out of water.
Yeah.
Come on. And then, my God, I get to the Uptown Theater. It's in a black neighborhood. All the musicians are black, And then I find out the audience is all black.
Of course.
Now, Joanne Campbell was a white girl. She was on the show. Yeah. I was the only white boy. I'm telling you, I absolutely just shook. And this guy comes over to me, puts his hands on my shoulder, takes me under his wing that whole week, and just became such a mentor to me. Clyde McFadder.
No.
Yes. Clyde McFadder became my mentor. And back in that day, there were speakeasies. And I'll never forget, after we finished all that show and we're walking down this dark street of Philadelphia. I got stories, brother.
Mm.
I got stories.
Okay.
I was told one time, you should sign up with one of these agencies that you go on book tours or lecture tours, because I've got all these stories from that era. And I say this very kindly.
Okay.
You won't hear this from Fabian, Bobby Rydell, Lou Christie, because the 60s were different from the 50s. There was a mindset. There was an aura. There was a fellowship in the 50s that was different from all the shows I did in the 60s. Totally different.
Mm.
They weren't anywhere near as close-knit as all of us were in the 50s. I could go on and on about that. And so we're walking down this dark alley, and the next thing I know, I'm going, "Whoa, my God, where are we, Clyde?" He said, "Well, just wait a minute. Now, this is something out of one of those Dracula movies, you know, the dark streets of the UK." And you're walking down, and there's mist in the air, and he knocks on this door, and a little peephole opens. And this black guy says, "Clyde." Oh, yeah. I'm telling you a fact, man. And so the door opens, and you go inside, and that's the biggest party going on you ever saw in your life. Everybody's drinking, and everybody's dancing, bands going on. And the black guy looks at Clyde, and then he looks at me. And Clyde says, "He's with me." And the guy said, "No problem."
Wow.
So that was how the ice was broken with me and other black artists. I never had a problem from that day on.
Nice.
And they never had a problem with me.
That's beautiful. And Clyde McFadder.
You are probably only one. I say this very matter-of-factly. First of all, Jimmy Clanton does not lie, and I don't exaggerate.
Good.
I don't exaggerate. I don't minimize. I tell it exactly how it happened.
Nice.
And I don't think in my 50 years now that I've told that story to an interviewer, other than maybe one other time. You're the second one, maybe, in 50 years.
Mm. Wow. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Jimmy Clanton, part of the lineup with Legends of the 60s Volume 3 in Ontario, November 16th. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. But the lineup includes the Modern Gentlemen, backing Frankie Valli for the last 15 years. We also have Brian Hyland, Paul and Paula, Dodie Stevens, and Bobby Rydell. We saw in 1959, Go Jimmy Go. This was another top 40 hit. And so there was a movie of the same title. Which one was first? Was this song written for the movie, or was this song?
No, what had happened was I had recorded Go Jimmy Go.
Okay.
Okay. And then Alan Freed comes over to me backstage at one of his big show, and just very nonchalantly, he says, "I'm getting ready to go to Hollywood." He said, "I'm getting ready to produce." I don't remember if he said my last. Come to find out, it was. He said, "My last rock and roll movie." And he told me a little about the storyline. And he said, "It's about this kid, Johnny Melody." And he said, "I'd like for you to play the lead because you'd be perfect for it." Now, here's another one for the archives.
Okay.
The actual movie was titled, and I even sent my original script, is now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, by the way.
Cool.
My original script for this. And the original script on the front says Johnny Melody, because that was to be the title. Well, what happened was is that Chuck Berry simultaneously comes out with this huge hit called Johnny Be Good. And, of course, the hook of that song was Go, Johnny, Go. Go, 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 Johnny, go. I used to sing it all the time on shows. So Alan Freed, being the exploiter that he was, he said, "I'm going to change the title of this movie, and it's going to be called Go Johnny Go," because he grabbed onto the Go Johnny Go, and in the movie, as the movie starts to play, Chuck Berry is singing that big hit, Johnny Be Good. Go, go, Johnny, go. So he changed the movie title from Johnny Melody to Go Johnny Go.
The song was Go Jimmy Go, but the movie ended up being called Go Johnny Go.
Now, I got a cute one for Go Jimmy. Go on, tell
okay.
you. Doc Pomus and Morty Schumann were very, very successful songwriters in New York. They wrote Save the Last Dance for Me, for the Drifters.
Yeah.
They wrote This Magic Moment, one of the classics.
Yes.
They wrote for Elvis. So they kept pumping me for songs. Well, I would listen to him because he was famous, you know, by that time, had so many hits. So he kept throwing songs at me, and so I don't forget how it came about. But I kind of liked that Go Jimmy Go. We're going to do the horns in the background, like my sound from the Swamp Pop. So we finished doing Go Jimmy Go with the background voices and everything. And as I'm walking out of the studio, I see the background voices, the girls, and the one girl from the group walks over and very, very bothersome look on her face. She says to me, "Jimmy, are you sure you never recorded this as Go Bobby Go?" I looked at her, I thought, "Are you crazy?" I said, "No." You know, I said, "My name is Jimmy Planted, you know, Go Jimmy Go." And I walked out like, you know, what's with her? Well, within a few months, backstage, and I'm doing a big multiple act show, and Bobby Rydell walks over to me. He said, "You son of a gun, you stole my song."
What?
I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I recorded Go Bobby Go, and they decided not to put it out. Next thing I know, Doc Pomus gives the song to you. You put it out as Go Jimmy Go, and it's a big hit." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Eat your heart out, baby." And then I eventually got a hold of Doc Pomus. I said, "You son of a gun." I said, "I'm going to break your neck." I said, "But I better not, because it became a top 10 hit for me, so I can't be too mad at you, no."
So, spoiler alert on the movie that we were speaking of here, it loosely has a storyline of a kid, you, who won a talent contest and doesn't know about it. The other people in the talent contest, I'm wondering if they were other popular musicians. In other words, this movie was perhaps just another vehicle for Alan Freed to, again, showcase popular musicians.
Actually, the storyline had nothing to do with anybody that you would know, much
okay.
less myself. That was all kept away from the script, and nothing was ever mentioned about who else was eligible for the award that I got in the movie at all.
Okay, excellent. All right, gotcha. You said that you had a story to sort of wrap this up.
Yeah, I've told this a couple of times in 50 years. I'm going to crack up myself when I think about it. Okay, now, there is a scene in Go Johnny Go.
Okay.
And the scene shows me, it's a long, long scene, and it shows this long avenue. And on this avenue, it shows me walking along, and you see different shops, okay, one after another, multiple shops. And it shows me coming up and stopping in front of this jewelry store.
Okay, cool.
And I don't have the money for an engagement ring. And I am so down because nothing's panned out with getting my song heard on the talent show with Alan Freed. I haven't heard back on that. And, you know, nothing's working out. Don't even have enough money to get my girl an engagement ring. And the spur-of-the-moment thing is I reach for a brick, and it was a real brick. I reach for the brick, I pick it up, and I go right there to the big show glass of the jewelry store, and I just crash in a piece on the edge there so I can reach in to steal this ring.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the scene is, okay?
Okay.
Now, as we're getting ready to shoot this scene, I come from back because this whole street scene is all one huge one, not multiple pieces, one huge piece of plywood. All those storefronts are painted on the plywood. It's a long, long piece of plywood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I come from the back of that, and I'm coming around because it's a scene where they have to wet the street. You know, there's a mist, and it's slightly rainy.
Mm-hmm.
And as I came around where Alan was sitting, I'm getting ready to do this, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this whole one piece. It's being held up by just a couple little 2x4s that are propped. I thought,
uh-huh.
Oh, is that how they do this? You know? So we get around. Okay, we're going to do a run-through. Okay? So I'm walking along the street, and I go and I pick up the brick. And as I walk to the jewelry store window, the back of my mind says, you know what? This thing is held up with one piece of plywood. If you really hit this window with that heavy brick, this whole thing could come over. I thought that, you know, real quickly. So in a run-through, I just kind of, namby-pamby, just touched the window with the brick because I didn't want. And immediately Alan Freed is over the corner. He said, stop, cut, cut. He said, what are you doing? He said, you don't do this in a namby-pamby, man. You're frustrated. You got to hit that window with the brick. I said, but Alan, I said, this thing is only held up with 1, 2, 5, 4. Oh, no, blah, 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 blah. Now you hit that window like you're a man. Like you're a man. Are you sure? He said, yes. Okay. So, here we go. Action. Action. So I go over, pick up the brick. I say my lines. I go to the jewelry store window, and I just crash. Man, I hit that. And honest to God, this is exactly what happened. All of a sudden, it was like a 9,500-foot redwood tree. You heard it. And the whole thing came crashing down when I hit that with the brick. The whole set. I'm talking about that thing was 50 feet long. It just all collapsed right there. A huge loud sound. Oh, my God, what have you done? I said, I told you I couldn't hit that thing heavy. And so that's exactly what happened. I knocked the whole damn thing totally over. It just crashed. So it took him at least an hour to get it back. And so they said, okay, we've got extra planking back there. But, yeah, I knocked the whole thing down.
I have to track down the movie just for that scene. Just for
you do. I promise you. You need to see the movie just for that. And she said, go, Jimmy, go. Go, Jimmy, go. Well, I talked her off the floor when she said, go, Jimmy, go. Go, Jimmy, go. Go, Jimmy, go.
That's music from and conversation with Jimmy Clanton, part of the lineup with Legends of the 60s Volume 3 in Ontario, November 16th. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Jimmy Clanton and to Nathan Gothels of Affordable Music Productions for initially getting me in touch with him. Thanks also to KVCR's Lillian Voska, send her interview from 2010 with Diane Carroll. Also at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Sharina Wadd, Natalie Colmer, and Benjamin Perper. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. It's quick and easy at kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.